I'm Robin Young. It's Here and Now. And the question in the Middle East today seems to be, will Israel launch a ground offensive into Gaza? Israel considered a 48-hour truce to allow humanitarian aid to flow into Gaza, but said that was dependent on Hamas militants ceasing their rocket fire. That didn't happen, and today Israel continued its air offensive. Nidal Amugrabi is in Gaza City. He's a veteran reporter for Reuters. Nidal, you write today that this conflict is now at a tipping point. How else would you characterize it?
At the moment, rocket attacks and cross-border attacks between Gaza and Israel is continuing. Militants are firing rockets deep into Israeli territory. The political situation is that Israel has rebuffed any truce proposal for now, saying that the time was not right for a ceasefire in the Gaza Strip. Hamas, from its side, said it was open to study a ceasefire proposal if a proposal guarantees an end to the Israeli blockade on Gaza Strip and an end to Israeli military strikes on Gaza Strip.
Well, the Associated Press is reporting that part of the Israeli decision to keep on fighting is that there are bigger and stronger weapons being used by Hamas, and these are weapons that have been smuggled through the tunnels along the border with Egypt. The AP says that previously Hamas had relied on crude homemade rockets that could just go maybe 12 miles, and now they're firing industrial-grade weapons. Do you have a sense of the difference in the weapons?
Yeah, there has been longer-range rockets used by Hamas. Yesterday, Hamas fired rockets that reached Beersheba, Yavne, and even Kiryat Malachi. These areas were not threatened by rockets before, and there is also a fear in Israel that Hamas may have longer-range rockets than they had used for now. Israel wants this ceasefire to guarantee that Hamas isn't going to fire these rockets again into Israeli territory.
Well, and we know in addition the Israeli air power is trying to bomb the tunnels through which these weapons are coming. But in the meantime, what do you see from your vantage point, Nidal, there in Gaza City? What do you see as any evidence of a possible ground attack?
We've seen in the past few days more Israeli reinforcement tanks and soldiers arriving to the areas near Gaza border in an apparent signal that Israel is ready to launch a ground offensive. But I would think that Israel is still in need for a political decision to send forces into the Gaza Strip. We all know that at the moment, Egypt and Turkey are involved in some diplomatic efforts in order to reach a ceasefire. Unless a realistic proposal for the two sides is reached, the Israeli ground offensive may take place any time the political echelon in Israel decides.
Nidal, Israel launched this offensive after Hamas ended a six-month truce by ratcheting up rocket fire towards Israel. How are Gazans feeling today? Are they feeling that Hamas made a serious mistake, or is this only making people support Hamas more?
Rocket fire has always been an issue of an internal debate. Some people are with the rocket fire, others oppose or question the wisdom of the use of rocket fire since they cause little damage in Israel and bring about devastating Israeli response. At the moment, in Gaza, it is very hard to assess whether people would blame Hamas or Israel or would blame both for the situation they live in, since there has been dozens of civilians killed in the offensive since Saturday. So the emotions are high, but the issue of rocket fire has been and always will be an issue of an internal debate in favor or against within the Palestinians.
Mm-hmm. Nidal Amugrabi, a Reuters reporter, speaking to us from Gaza City. Nidal, by the way, are you Palestinian?
I am.
Well, thank you very much for your insight.
You're welcome.
And we turn now to Leila Haddad. She's also a Palestinian journalist who now lives in North Carolina. You can get to her blog, A Mother from Gaza, at our website, here-now.org. And she's also given us permission to bring a family member into the conversation. But Leila, first, what are your thoughts on this internal debate in Gaza we just heard about? The last time you were there, Hamas and the more moderate Fatah were fighting. Hamas won, forcing Fatah out of Gaza into the West Bank. Is there some sense from people you talked to that that was a mistake? What are you hearing Gazans say about Hamas?
To be honest, people are really just thinking about surviving right now. I mean, they've been prevented from, you know, basic medicines, chemotherapy, kidney dialysis. Families have been separated. You know, this is what people are thinking about.
Well, and what about the smuggling tunnels that we just heard about? You've been there. Israel says that they are increasingly being used by Hamas for more powerful rockets.
I mean, these tunnels have become really a source of livelihood for the people of Gaza. You know, yeah, sure, in the past, people, residents itself, and this was in the film that I made, complained about, you know, the, what they call the tunnel lords, bringing in things that were unnecessary, like bullets. But increasingly, over the past years, people have come to rely on the tunnels for things that are unavailable because of the Israeli blockade.
Well, Leila, as we said, you've been in touch with your family and friends, and listeners can read what they're saying at your blog, but we also wanted to call up your dad, Dr. El-Haddad, who is in Gaza. Dr. El-Haddad, are you there?
Yes, I am.
What is your sense of what's happening today in Gaza? Do you go out? What do you do?
Well, I just went to pray and just came back about 10 minutes ago. I heard that they just bombed a mosque in an area in Gaza called Tal el-Hawa, and that was number 8 mosque worship place to be bombed with 4 rockets.
Well, and Dr. El-Haddad, you know, we hear that Hamas militants are storing weapons in mosques.
Well, if you talk about weapons and rockets, yesterday one family, a mother was wounded and 5 of her daughters were killed with rockets. Were they carrying rockets in their homes? I tell you, the situation here is impossible. What hurts you most is that in front of the whole world this is happening and nobody is doing or saying anything.
How safe is it at the moment to leave, to walk around in that area of Gaza City?
Well, just to answer you, until this moment, me and your mother are alive. But I cannot tell you what's going to happen after 5 minutes. And this is how unsafe it is. I mean, I saw rockets being launched in the back street behind my house, and I sent you a picture of that house. And I saw rockets being launched at the university, the biggest university in Gaza. And yesterday they launched a rocket at one of the families that I know. It's called Dalul. They have a milk factory downstairs in the basement. And that, as far as I know, milk cannot produce weapons or rockets or anything.
Leila, what do you say to Americans? I just heard someone call into a talk show to say, you know, why aren't Palestinians telling Hamas to stop firing the rockets? You know, it's perceived that Hamas broke the 6-month truce by firing more rockets in November.
Often this comes up, especially in American media, about the rocket firing or the truce or who broke the truce. But besides the point, as we see it, the Israeli version of a truce is, we can shoot you, we can starve you. If you shoot back, we'll bomb you. And, I mean, that's really how Palestinians are seeing it. A truce in Gaza is really untenable in the absence of economic or political relief for the Palestinians and ultimately an end to the occupation of the Gaza Strip and the West Bank.
For time, and again, because we want you to remain safe, Dr. El-Haddad, I don't know if you want to say so long to Leila. You are in close touch, but I'll give you that opportunity now.
Thank you very much. Okay, Baba, take care and don't worry about us. Allah is here with us. And if something happens, just take care of yourself and your children.
That's Dr. El-Haddad in Gaza, speaking with his daughter Leila Haddad in North Carolina. Again, you can read her blog, A Mother from Gaza, at our website, here-now.org. Well, as expected, cities and states in the U.S. are really feeling the economic meltdown. Massachusetts Governor Deval Patrick just announced $1 billion in additional budget cuts. California has asked state workers to take 2 unpaid days off a month. And New Hampshire is suspending jury trials for a month. We're going to hear about that in a minute. But 11 public libraries on the chopping block in Philadelphia have received a stay of execution. They were supposed to permanently shut down today, but yesterday a judge blocked the closing, saying the city council must first vote on the matter. The city says the closures would save a needed $8 million a year. Well, Amy Dougherty is executive director of Friends of the Free Library. Amy, your thoughts when you heard you'd been given a reprieve?
Oh, we were just thrilled, ecstatic. It was just wonderful.
Well, but Mayor Mike Nutter says he's going to appeal the judge's ruling. And before the judge's decision yesterday, Nutter said that 5 of the 11 libraries would be taken over by unnamed private companies. So there's a sense that this story isn't over. What is your thinking? What would you think about privatizing some of the libraries?
Well, I think that there isn't anything essentially wrong with it. I think it's a good short-term fix. It's what I'm calling the third way. It is the third option, and it's not a bad option, but as I said, it would be our third choice.
Are you worried, you know, with privatization or, you know, turning it over to a nonprofit company, that you lose control over who the librarians are, what books are there? I mean, is that part of why you'd like to have it be a city function?
Well, number one, you know, anybody who, whether it's a private or a public library, whoever works in the library would have to go through police background check. So that's one of the details that would have to be put in place. So that's not my major concern, but our libraries lend throughout the 54-branch system. So that would be a question. What about the lending library piece of it?
In other words, you're worried that if you take these 11 libraries out of the huge citywide system, then they are taken out of everything that brings, including book lending.
Exactly.
Yeah, well, we understand that the school systems around these libraries have shut down their own libraries, so kids are going to the public libraries because they have nowhere else to go.
Correct. Maybe 25% of the schools have libraries, and even the ones that they do may or may not have accredited librarians, may not have books, and school libraries aren't open once the school is closed. So students in Philadelphia use the public library. It is their de facto library. These communities are, all of them have double-digit people living in poverty.
Well,
citizens of Philadelphia really need their libraries. Over 50% of us do not have home computers. So if you want to apply for a job, you have to go to the library, which is a fine thing because all our libraries do have computers and excellent library staff to help people who don't know how to use them.
Well, we know other states wrestled with this issue, Oregon, for instance, and they tried a property tax levy. It seemed pretty small, you know, a few dollars a year, but voters turned it down. I mean, you know, how do you get people, maybe they take to the streets and they protest, but how do you get them to open their pocketbooks for a library?
A group actually here in Philadelphia did a poll specifically and asked the citizens about specifically whether they would agree to an increase in their taxes in order to keep libraries open, and the answer was yes.
Well, Amy, as we said, the libraries will be open for now. We'll keep an eye on this story in the new year. Thanks so much.
Thank you so much.
Amy Dougherty, Executive Director of Friends of the Free Library in Philadelphia. Okay, just ahead, we're going to check in with a prosecutor in New Hampshire where jury trials are going to be put on hold for a month because of budget concerns. And later today, recently discovered audio tapes tell the hard luck story of the late author Richard Yates. He was the master of hard luck stories like Revolutionary Road. That's the novel he wrote that the new movie is based on. That's later today. We'll be back in a minute with more on state budget cuts here and now. We've been hearing about the impact of state budget cuts, and here's another. We all know the image of blind justice holding a scale. Well, blind justice is also broke. At least 19 states have slashed court budgets as the economy sours. In New Hampshire, all sectors of state government were asked to trim, and the state court system responded by calling a temporary one-month halt to all jury trials in February because they don't have the $73,000 for juror per diem payments. Well, New Hampshire is grappling with a $250 million budget shortfall, and the state Supreme Court Chief Justice has already pruned $3 million from the court system and is going to leave the seat of a retiring justice vacant to save money there as well. James Reams is a prosecutor in one of the busiest courts in New Hampshire up in Rockingham County. Jim, what does it mean for you as a prosecutor that they're going to postpone jury trials for a month?
Well, we had 77 trials that were canceled as a result of the court's order, so we had already subpoenaed a lot of witnesses and done trial preparation for all of those cases. Unfortunately, all that effort is wasted because it all has, almost all of it has to be redone whenever the cases are rescheduled.
77 trials. That's a lot of trials that are postponed. Can you just give us an example of, you know, what an individual trial is and what it might mean to the participants that they have to now wait? I don't know if there's an example that comes to mind.
Well, we have rape cases where we had victims ready to testify, and now essentially they've been told to wait. So they have to go through the trauma of preparing for trial, only to be told they're going to have to do this all again at some point in the future. And eventually we fear, you know, victim burnout and witness burnout, and they just walk away from the criminal justice system
right.
in disgust.
Well, isn't there sort of a legal angle to this? Don't criminal defendants have a right to a speedy trial? Isn't that one of the rights that's offered? And what happens if they don't get that? Might they have some recourse?
Ultimately, our fear is that you get, essentially, you've created, you know, get-out-of-jail-free cards because the system cannot process the cases in a constitutionally acceptable manner, and so the cases get dismissed. That hasn't happened yet, but if this continues, we will all be looking at that issue and fighting over that issue.
Well, the state Supreme Court already threw out two criminal cases this year because the trials didn't begin within 6 months of arraignment. So there's some precedent there. But what about the costs? I mean, do the clients have to pay if, well, for instance, the Los Angeles Times reported on a property rights trial in Newport, New Hampshire that was postponed four times. It's getting bounced again because of this new delay. And the clients have to pay for all the extra work.
Yes, they do. You know, in the criminal justice system, it's the public that pays because the defense lawyers most of them are being paid by public funds. The prosecutors are all being paid for by public funds, as are all the law enforcement agencies involved. So the public pays in the criminal justice system for the most part.
That's Jim Reams. He's a prosecutor in Rockingham County, New Hampshire, which has postponed all juror trials for the month of February because of budget shortfall. Jim, thanks for speaking to us about it.
Thank you for having me.
Well, let's turn now to Daniel Hall. He's Vice President of Court Consulting Services at the National Center for State Courts. Dan, how does New Hampshire contrast with other states? Are other states going through this?
Well, this is becoming a very widespread problem throughout the United States. You know, there's the state courts in this country handle 47 million cases a year. That's criminal, civil, and family cases. And so they are the front line in providing a fair and impartial and timely resolution of disputes. And we've got now, as you stated, at least 19 states that are facing problems similar to New Hampshire, where the budgets are being cut. New Hampshire is one of the poster children, but also you have California that's taken a $200 million cut. You've got Minnesota that's taken $20 million this year, $40 million yet next. Florida is in particularly deep problems. They've had a 10% cut in the budget this year, so it's forced them to lay off 280 clerks, lawyers, and other staff that support the judge. And they're talking about another 10%, and that would mean that all of the civil cases in Florida would virtually be suspended.
How can you do that? I mean, it just doesn't feel as if that's possible. Would they have other recourse? Would they hopscotch directly to federal court?
In the last recession, 2001-2003, courts were forced to really prioritize some of the functions that they do. So, for example, the state of Oregon prioritized all their case types, with small claims being the least priority. The reason it hits courts a little deeper than other executive branch agencies is that court budgets are 90% people. And so when you cut, you're cutting people that are providing services. And courts are here to provide fair and impartial and timely resolution of disputes. And when courts are not able to do this, you threaten the very fabric of our society.
Well, and we know that cities and states are getting ready for more cutbacks, I mean, as the economic downturn ripples out. And so, I mean, what would they do? Judge Judy, contract out for court services?
It's very difficult. Again, in the last recession, 60% of the states raised the fees and fines to cover the gap in the revenue. And that forced many states to raise the filing fees up to fairly astronomical amounts. California, I think, is $350 for a civil case, and that's before you start adding on motions and that. Colorado is about the same way. So that alternative to cover the gap is not there. And so what you may be looking at is that courts will have to be forced to look at radically different ways to deliver their services. And that could be on the table, reducing the number of courthouses, using more and more electronic means of handling court business, people showing up to handle traffic cases and having a hearing, and you may just do away with that and have them pay it through an ATM. And some of these things are an opportunity, but some of these things you do not want to impede upon that fair and impartial and timely resolution of disputes. And it's at the expense of the civil and the family cases, because those cases get pushed to the rear of the docket. And so people are not getting their day in court.
Daniel Hall is Vice President of Court Consulting Services at the National Center for State Courts, which is a nonprofit that represents courts. Dan, thanks so much for speaking to us.
You're welcome.
Okay, tomorrow on Here and Now, on New Year's Day 50 years ago, Fidel Castro declared victory in Cuba. Is there a new revolution on the horizon? That's tomorrow. Still ahead today, are you stuck with a car lease you can't pay anymore, or are you looking for a car lease? Well, have we got possibly a deal for you? After the news, Here and Now. Leasing a car has long been an attractive alternative for new car buyers who want lower monthly payments and don't necessarily care about owning the car. You basically rent a new car for a few years, and when the term is up, you either walk away or buy the remaining value of the car and take it home. But getting out of a lease before the contract is up is near impossible. It usually carries a hefty fine, and in times of layoffs, well, who wants to be locked into payments if you lose your job? Enter the option of lease for trade. There are several online companies that offer lease for trade programs. It's not a new concept, but our next guest says it's being used a lot more. Joining us from Miami is John Sternall. He's the spokesperson for leasetrader.com, one of the pioneers in this industry. And John, from what we understand, your company and others like it match up people who want to get out of their car leases with people who want to take them over. Is that right?
Yes, exactly. And thank you for having me on today. The whole concept came about when a gentleman by the name of Sergio Stieberman was leasing a vehicle. And he had about, I'd say, 10 or 11 months remaining on his lease contract. He was bored with his car. The honeymoon period was over. So he went back to the dealer. And the dealer told him that he would have to break his lease to get out of the contract, which meant he'd have to pay all of the remaining payments, or the balance of the lease. At the time, that totaled $14,000.
Wow.
And so, yeah, of course. So what Sergio basically ended up doing was creating the online marketplace known today as leasetrader.com, which lets you transfer your remaining portion of your lease contract over to somebody else anywhere in the country.
Well, boy, that is a huge difference between leasing a car and buying a car, because when you get tired of your car or you lose a job and can't make the payments, you just sell it. But in a lease, well, you have to pay off the contract.
That's the situation that millions of Americans find themselves in. They feel stuck and trapped in this contract, and when the bank is telling you your only real way out is to pay me this $10,000 check, especially in this economy, it's really a financially disastrous situation to be in.
So what are you seeing? Are you seeing the economy, the bad economy, reflected in how many people are trying to get out of their leases?
Right now, it's between 25% and 30% of our customers that are escaping leases or getting out of their lease contracts because they've lost their job. Some have gone through foreclosure, or their mortgages are turning on them. They're stuck in this slow, horrible economy, and they need desperately to find a way to cut their bills. And since the car payment is typically the second largest monthly bill in a household, you know, being able to chop a couple of $100 off of that car payment right away, that's big relief for a lot of folks.
Well, let's talk about how it works. I'm on your website, and it looks as if you can search for different cars. You can search for cars in your region. You can search for certain kinds of cars. And then people who are the original leaseholders can tell you exactly what the monthly payment is, but there's also some bartering. They can give you a reduced payment. What happens then? Does the original leaseholder give up the car but still have to cover the cost of the rest of the monthly payment?
If you're in a car lease contract and you're paying, let's say you're paying $800 a month on a BMW 3 Series, let's just say, and you go on leasetrader.com and you see that the majority of people are listing their BMW 3 Series for $500 a month. Well, in order to make it so that you are competitive with all those other people, we offer a what's called an advertised list price. So we're going to go ahead and let you list your vehicle for whatever price you feel is competitive or aggressive. And then whatever is the balance of the remaining of the lease, there's obviously an understanding that you're going to go ahead and pick that up.
Wow. But people have to be pretty desperate. I'm also seeing here that people are giving cash incentives. One person who's leasing a 2007 BMW 5 Series is giving an incentive of $2,000 to someone to pick up this lease for them.
You know, what we've found is that it still works to the first leaseholder's benefit, because if you have to pick up $2,000 to cover the remaining balance, you're still coming out way ahead compared to having to pay $10,000 or $12,000 to outright break the lease. So we're actually seeing a lot of people take advantage of this type of a program.
Right. Tell us who, you know, we can see on the one side, if someone wants to get out of a lease, how this would benefit them, especially if they're desperate. But how does this benefit people who might pick up a lease?
It's actually the untold story here at leasetrader.com. Most people think of the company as, you know, we're the company that gets you out of your lease. And although that's true, the benefits can sometimes be a lot better on the flip side, where we help you take over somebody's lease. Number one, there's no down payment involved, because the down payment, as we all know, has already been paid by the first leaseholder. And the second benefit is that you're only picking up what's left on the lease. You're not rewriting the contract. You're not renewing the contract. So in today's economy, where a lot of people are really afraid or not willing to make such a long-term financial commitment, it's great for somebody that just wants to, you know, take a car payment for 9 months at a time.
Right. So, and especially if you're relocating, let's say you're going to Cleveland for 10 months to give yourself 10 months to find a job, well, then you can find a car that has 10 months left on the contract.
Yeah, we do know of a lot of customers that, you know, maybe they're in a freelance situation, or maybe they're a small business owner that works for themselves, and they've got a short-term project coming up with a client that's maybe going to last about 6 months, but they need a vehicle that's going to kind of fit their situation for that 6 month period. It would cost a lot of money for them to just rent a car for that time frame, so this is also an ideal situation for them.
Well, but let's look at the downside, because we read in many cases the companies that handle the original leases, whether it's Honda's leasing division, or Bank One, they often require that the original leaseholder's name stays on the contract. So if someone may ever want to unload a car through leasetrader.com, they might consider that, because, you know, if you can't get your name off, you know, somebody who picks up that lease might default and you're responsible.
The very first thing we advise our customers to do is to definitely check with their lease company to make sure that their lease company allows for a transfer. Fortunately, I'd say 95% of all the companies out there are full participants in our program and allow for full transfers. But yes, there are a few banks and companies out there that place certain restrictions on the process, and they definitely want to check with that. You know, these are unfriendly policies that these companies have, and eventually they'll change because of customer demand, but we're here fighting on behalf of our customers to get them to alleviate these policies.
Well, you may be doing that, but what I guess I'm seeing is, for the time being, it's buyer beware. You know, somebody has to make sure for themselves, because you are certainly not responsible if a second lease person defaults on the lease.
Yeah, we're just the matchmaker, so yeah. We never take ownership of the vehicle or resell or release or anything like that. We definitely advise all of our customers to make sure that they're fully aware of what their lease contracts state.
That's John Sternel, spokesperson for leasetrader.com. I should add, there's a couple of fees. There's a listing fee for listing your car. There's sort of a membership fee if you're going to shop for one and go through a credit check. And the parties are responsible for getting the cars to and fro, right?
Correct.
Okay. John, thanks so much for speaking with us.
Thank you so much for having me today.
You're listening to Here and Now. Have you seen the new film, Revolutionary Road?
All I know, April, is I want to feel things. Really feel them.
I think you're the most interesting person I've ever met.
That's A Scene, starring Leonardo DiCaprio and Kate Winslet as Frank and April Wheeler, whose love withers in 1950s suburbia. Well, Revolutionary Road is based on the 1961 novel of the same name by the late author Richard Yates, and critics have said the character of Frank Wheeler is autobiographical. Well, here's what Richard Yates had to say.
All the shitty qualities that I sensed were possible in myself, I ascribed to him.
Those words from the late Richard Yates come from an extraordinary afternoon he spent with Boston journalist Daniel Gewirtz in 1985. At that time, Daniel was a young cub. Yates was an established author who'd been hailed in the 60s as America's foremost novelist of the post-World War II age of anxiety. He was also, by 1985, a wreck. They met in a bar in Boston, and the cassette recordings of that interview sat in Dan's closet for decades until now. And Daniel Gewirtz joins us to tell more of the story. Daniel, welcome.
Thank you, Robin.
But let's start by backing up. Give us some more biography. Who was Richard Yates?
Well, Yates was born in 1926, and he had a rather miserable childhood that he never got over, and he continually wrote about. He went into the army when he was 18, fought in the Battle of the Bulge. And I would say that he's the only man I ever met who felt that the great one lucky break of his life was contracting tuberculosis.
Because?
They were able to trace it back to the pleurisy of World War II. And even though it was the early 50s, he got this compensation as a GI, and he was able to go to Paris and write for 2 years.
Right, which is, by the way, what the couple that he writes about in Revolutionary Road, Frank and April Wheeler, want to do. They want to go to Paris and strike out anew. So here we have this author who at times shows brilliance. He was a speechwriter for Robert Kennedy, but at the same time, the FBI warned Kennedy off of him because he was an alcoholic and a security risk.
And a manic depressive in the parlance of the times.
And he had had great success writing.
His first book sold only 11,000 copies, but it was nominated for a National Book Award. That's Revolutionary Road. For many years, it was considered his only great book. But his reputation far exceeded his popularity.
Yeah. Well, so now we fast forward to when you meet him, again, an author with several books behind him, a stint as a speechwriter for Robert Kennedy. But you meet him in a bar in Boston. He's moved to Boston. He's teaching at Boston University.
I didn't know what I was getting myself into because there was no internet back then. And I had about a paragraph description of who he was. And so when I walked in, I didn't even know I was going to be interviewing an alcoholic, right, no less one of the most famous literary drunks in history.
Right, who patterned himself on F. Scott Fitzgerald.
The fact that he patterned himself after Fitzgerald and Hemingway was probably his downfall because it legitimized his drinking in
right.
his own mind.
And as he said to you, he was a wreck and he wrote about wrecks. I mean, that's what he knew. And it's very difficult to listen to him speak because everything you guys talk about is fueled by the alcohol he's drinking. For instance, he talks about how he doesn't take care of himself. Let's listen.
I'm not taking very good care of myself right now, but I am working, which has always before been my redemption.
So why do you say you're not taking good care of yourself?
Oh, because I drink a lot. And keep funny hours. Now, listen, my saying I drink a lot is not going to be in your feature, is it?
You don't want it to be.
No. I mean, no, I don't want that line in there. Check it out.
Here you are, a young person, maybe confronted with this severe level of alcoholism for the first time, and it's in an interview. You know, what are you thinking?
I was not prepared. I was used to short interviews with musicians and actors, people who really knew how to put their best foot forward. And here's a man who didn't know how to put his best foot forward, probably was against the entire idea, and he got drunker and drunker as the day went by. I filled about 3 hours worth of tape, and it really got kind of incomprehensible after a while, which is the most tragic thing for a writer, to kind of get to the point where you don't use words cogently.
Well, we want to hear more from Daniel Gewirtz about his interview with Richard Yates, and we'll do that in 1 minute here and now.
Support for Here and Now comes in part from the Rockefeller Foundation and its Campaign for American Workers. More at rockfound.org.
Welcome back to our conversation with Boston journalist Daniel Gewirtz about his recently discovered 1985 interview with the late Revolutionary Road author Richard Yates. And one question we want to ask is why Daniel's using this material now when Yates didn't want him to use some of it back then. But first, here's Yates talking about his search for love.
And I don't know why I can't meet a nice girl who would agree to make a home with me, but I can't seem to. It's nothing to do with booze, it's just that I can't seem to.
Needless to say, the creator of the miserable 50s suburbanites Frank and April Wheeler of Revolutionary Road was pretty miserably drunk himself at this time. Daniel, Yates had an interesting take on alcoholism. He said it was okay if you were successful, it wasn't if you weren't. Let's listen.
When a man dies at the end, after his peak, when nothing he's done has been a success, it said of him that he descended into alcoholism. Whereas when he's on the up side, it is said of him that he loved good whiskey. You see the difference. Descending into alcoholism is no different than loving good whiskey. No different.
This is very sad.
Well, a lot of times he was very coherent talking about literature. We talked about our favorite books. He was quite analytic about how to create a character. He was talking about Frank and April Wheeler, for instance, as people who are deluded and they don't know themselves or each other, and so they had to have a tragic end. So he wasn't always a drunken mess during this interview, but it did get more depressing and disgusting as it went along. He would curse more and more. So after a while, I was thinking, what am I going to do here? Everything he's saying is apparently off the record. I can't talk about his drinking. At one point, he told me I could not even mention that he was Robert Kennedy's speechwriter, that he was saving that for a work of fiction that he was about to write, which, in fact, was his last work remaining unfinished at his death.
Yeah. Well, speaking of death, the New York Times' Charles McGrath wrote that Yates was a caricature of the self-destructive American writer. You say that was pretty much your take as well, that he could veer from being pitiful to bragging.
His bragging was not really bragging about himself. He didn't really have a bloated ego, but he did have great contempt for the Kennedys, for instance. And I think he had contempt for everyone that was hugely successful. At the same time, he had great sympathy for the losers of life, which he considered himself one of.
For instance, his brother-in-law? He told you about his brother-in-law?
His brother-in-law became a character in two of his novels, and he more or less beat his sister to death, or at least helped her death along.
Now, let's be clear here. Richard Yates' brother-in-law, who was married to Richard Yates' sister, there is speculation that he beat the sister, who was an alcoholic as well, and might have added to her death.
Yes, there was a blow, and she hit her head after he hit her, and this was what apparently she died of. But in his books, he took that character, got inside the guy's head, and had sympathy and empathy for him, even though he was a rather horrid beast in real life. He wrote about people who were not heroes, and yet he had a great deal of sympathy for them, and maybe that's one of the reasons why these books never sold in their first printing.
Because in the 50s and 60s, people wanted heroic characters.
In the early 60s, he was considered too depressing and probably too forthright and honest about America. And by the late 60s and early 70s, he all of a sudden was old-fashioned. He was a realist. He wasn't a fancy stylist like a John Barth. He was really kind of an old fuddy-duddy all of a sudden.
Well, but for all his bragging to you, he also was at moments kind of pitiful. For instance, in talking about mortality, let's listen.
I'm not going to go any place except down from here. I'm going to check out pretty soon, and I'd like to get 15 books written before then, but only for reasons of vanity.
Are you interested in extending your life as long as you can?
Oh, yes, of course. I'm scared shit to die. And one of the reasons I keep looking for a girl is that I think she might prolong my life. I mean, some girl is out there someplace that will prolong my life.
One of the misnomers about Yeats is that he's against suburbia and against marriage, and his books are screeds against those institutions, if you could call suburbia an institution. He loved the idea of marriage. He thought of it as life's great adventure. He only grieved because he was not good at it himself. He thought of as women as his possible salvation.
Well, it's just fascinating tape. Now, you never turned it into an article as a young man in 85.
I really didn't know what to do with this because I was used to shorter stories about upbeat people. And here was this messy, complex, tragic, drunken confliction of a man who just was too messy to write something sweet about.
Well, and, you know, has your opinion of him changed as you've grown older and pulled these tapes out and listened to them again?
I think of him now as kind of a hero because he had so little going for him, and yet he remained a writer every step of the way. He never stopped writing. In this Boston period, he published four books, five if you consider the publication of his old Hollywood screenplay. So I think he was a man that had great fortitude, great energy for writing, and little aptitude for life.
Well, the creator of the TV series Mad Men is a fan of the books. The author Richard Ford is quoted as saying that the books are passed around like a secret literary handshake. And now, of course, Revolutionary Road is up on the big screen. What do you think he'd think about all that?
He probably would be derisive of any Hollywood movie of his books, but he'd be so happy that his reputation was on the rise, and extremely happy that he's come back into style because he never really had a first act. His books were always critically lauded. Other writers adored him. Kurt Vonnegut went out of his way to try to publicize him wherever he went. But this is the first time that he has a bestseller.
Yeah. Well, when you were a young man, you thought he, Richard Yeats, was just a pathetic case. Now, as a 58-year-old, you see him as a more complex man, and now you know what to do with these tapes, and you look at them with the wisdom that you've accrued. But did you have any qualms about making them public, considering how sad they are?
Well, Richard Yeats is now dead for 16 years, and I didn't really have any moral qualms about it. Maybe I should have. Maybe that's my tragic flaw. But I think he would have enjoyed the fame, if not the particulars.
Yeah. Freelance journalist Daniel Gewirtz talking about his encounter in 1985 with author Richard Yeats. Daniel, thanks so much for telling us the story.
Thanks, Robin.